My name is Chaz. I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Everyone online, all five of you, four of you. Sorry. Let's see. My sobriety date is February 8th, 1999. I have a sponsor. I am a sponsor. My home group is a men's. We are a step meeting. It is a step meeting. And on Monday night, 7:30, men's step in recovery. Come join us if you can. It's an old Midlothian, Coldfield Midlothian Turnpike. If you're ever in Richmond or Chesterfield on Monday nights. Let's see. That's about it. Sponsored. Go to a lot of meetings. I've been sober for a while, and I still go to a lot of meetings. Every once in a while, I get asked, do you still go to those meetings from some old friends? It's like, yeah, I still go to those meetings. How long do you have to go to? I'm not sure. I haven't been told yet. And that kind of, that's really kind of how I've looked at my whole sobriety. So when I got here, I was broken. And the things that were taught to me to get unbroken, to find that path to a power greater than myself, which is talked about on page 29. All those things that worked then continue to work today. And there's no reason to switch it. Now, I will go into this in a few minutes, but I've had definitely periods of my sobriety where I have not followed all the instructions, where I followed my instructions, the ones that were most convenient to me at the time and given my circumstances. And I've reaped some of those benefits, which were not fun. But I guess I'm here to say or tell you guys what was, in a general way, what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I got sober in 1999. That is 26 years. I'm not that old. I got sober when I was 20. So I don't have a lot of the not yets that, alcoholics had when I got here, because I wasn't old enough to have a wife or a relationship of any kind. I didn't have a job. I was still in school. I did have employment when I wasn't in school, so I definitely had the experiences of, getting too drunk to go to work or being drunk on the job or not. They didn't really care if I caught on the job. I got caught on the job a couple of times, but they didn't really care. So I had plenty of the not yets, but not a lot of the other things that other alcoholics making, their story look a certain way or their life look a certain way. So when I came in here, I really had to identify with the feelings and the way people drank and why they drank, not necessarily what happened to them when they drank, the things that they lost. So I guess when I was younger, I really don't remember my first drink. I do remember my first. I wrestled with this one. There are two drunks early in my sobriety that I remember very vividly. I don't remember which one came first, but they both had the same exact experience where, I kind of grew up and I was always anxious as a child. They're talking about me behind my back or they're, over there. I went to the same school for 13 years. And even when I graduated, I still didn't feel like a part of the crowd. It's just kind of how awkward I felt. But somewhere along the lines of 13, 14, two different instances. One of them was at Jimmy Clary's house, Boyd's younger brother. My wife knows one of his older brothers. Five of us got together. We all got drunk, and I felt a part of a crowd. I felt a part of finally, and I'd never known what that felt like until that point. Didn't get real drunk that. But the other one was with four other people. It was four, so it was five total. Ryan Taylor's house. That was the first night that I got room spinning drunk, and I loved it. All of my cares went away, and the five of us together, I felt like we had formed a pack. I felt like these are my people, and these will be my people to the day I die. I had never felt that way until that time. The book talks about the feeling of ease and comfort that comes over us when we take that first drink. Well, it wasn't the first drink, but that was the first drunk where I felt that ease and comfort of being okay in my own skin. Whatever that looked like, whatever fears I had, I didn't know I had, they were gone. Drink, no fear, I can do what I want. So that was the formula I used for the rest of my life. Well, until I was 20. Anytime I had that feeling, It's like, oh my God, now I got to go find out how to get, drink. Let's go drink. Now, being that young, obviously you can't drink at all times, but anytime I could, I drank. It wasn't all the time, almost always on the weekends. My parents had a liquor cabinet, were very social, and lots of people over all the time. So there was always liquor of some sort laying around. I couldn't stand the crap they drank. It was bourbon, it's like wild turkey, and I still can't even smell that stuff today. It's gross. So I would force myself to, because I was the only one thing there, but they, there'd be some beers and things like that. I think where my drinking took off was when I got my driver's license. That was another spot in my life where instant friendships happened. People wanted to be part of my life because I was one of the older ones in my year. I got my license early. So they're like, hey, Chaz, there's a party this weekend. If you want to go, can you take me? It's like, yes, that can happen. So I got my driver's license when I was a sophomore. So I was going to like juniors and seniors parties and things. And I was like, I have arrived, man. People want to be around me. They want to be near me. They want they wanted my car is what they wanted. But I didn't care. It's like, you wanted to be part of my life because I had something to offer. Great. I also looked older. I had a fake ID so I could also get beer. It's another way to, get instant friends. They don't look old and have beards and, facial hair and 6 foot tall when they're a sophomore. And, I looked the part. So that was really drinking, and that whole, any kind of party scene was, that's what I fell into. That's what took away that weird feeling that I couldn't put my finger on when I was a kid. I didn't know what it was. Today I know it was just a God-sized hole in my body, in my heart, in my thinking. I just never felt a part of. There are some non-alcoholic items in my list. We'll call them alcohol enhancers, however you want to call it. I am not an addict. I definitely have used lots of drugs in my past. They were all from working with my sponsor and talking about how I used and why I used. It was all to enhance the effects of alcohol. You take some of the stuff over here and you could make 6 beers turn into 24. You could take some of this stuff over here and you could drink for 3 or 4 days straight. Great. Perfect. Manage my alcohol with other substances. Great. I was able to put that stuff down where I was not able to put the alcohol down. I always reached for alcohol first. I never had that craving that the book talks about. It's isolated to alcoholics. I never had that kind of craving for drugs. Used lots of them. Never had it. I guess called me up. Hard user of those kinds of things, not a real addict. I'm a real alcoholic, not a hard drinker or a moderate drinker. Reason I brought that up, towards the end of high school, I got a knock on my parents' front door from Henrico County with a multi-jurisdictional grand jury subpoena to talk about some things I had been doing off to the side and maybe on school grounds, which was frowned upon. And that was my first introduction to some sort of consequence of my actions. And I never had any consequences of that because my parents just kind of made it go away. They got me an attorney and it just disappeared. Part of it was I was leaving the state to go to Texas to school. And they were like, just don't come back very often and we'll be fine. I said, okay, fine. And I didn't really have any plans of coming back very often. I mean, I was going to be in school for 4 years and I didn't look like I was going to be back for a while. So they were like, okay. So near miss with going to jail for, there were years, it wasn't months, it was years, for dealing drugs on school grounds. That was not good. So driver's license was a kickoff to another level of drinking. Having the fake ID, another level of drinking. But really, what was my last blocker to drinking the way I wanted to drink? Because all up until now, my parents are in the way of my drinking because I don't want to get caught because I know they'll stop the drinking. I don't want to get caught at school because I get kicked out of school. Obviously, the cops are there. Don't want to get caught with the cops. All these little barriers to drinking the way I want to drink. Well, I go off to SMU in Dallas, Texas. I am 1,300 miles away from my parents, which are pretty much the last blocker to drinking the way I want to drink. and I went balls to the wall. Sorry. Nuts. I went nuts. Day one, I meet my people. Jay. Jay's from Pennsylvania. He's an East Coast boy. We're another country, basically. Texas is his own country. We met day one. I'm Facebook friends with him today still. So almost 30 years later. He had a car. I didn't have a car. He drank like I did. He did some other enhancers like I did. So we were just two peas in a pod. And just, I don't know how we meet each other. Anywhere we go, we meet each other, whether it's sober or drunk. I meet a lot of us sober when I go out. But no matter where I was when I was drinking, I always met my crowd somehow. And met someone else at the same time. And we started from then on. From the second my parents left, because they took my stuff, and said, here you go, great, hugs, kisses, goodbyes, gone. And I was out that night, and I was trashed that night. And that just continued. I could drink when I wanted, when I wanted, where I wanted to. I was living in a dorm. They didn't really check anyone. They didn't care. As long as you weren't burning the house down, they really did not care. And that was exactly what I needed to have for me, because I was tired of sneaking around and not drinking the way I wanted to drink. School looked like I started with 5 classes. I had to drop 2 because I was failing, and I still ended up with like a D with 3 classes. I'm not in sports. I have no other responsibilities other than just go to class, and I wasn't going to class. I was drinking. My first report card when I came home was pathetic, to say the least. And I, at this point, I had introduced some harder non-alcoholic things, outside issues, however you want to call it, into my system and on a regular basis. So when I came home for the Christmas break, I decided to take a break from all the non-alcohol issues and just drink. So I'm just going to take a break from everything else, and I'm just going to get drunk. So I worked for my father, got drunk every time I could get, and I don't think at that point I thought there was a serious problem, but I know at that point I started to think that I was drinking differently than everyone else. I was drinking with, some of these guys over here on a Monday, some of these guys over here on a Tuesday, some of these guys on a Wednesday, because somewhere along the line, I knew that I didn't want this group to know I was drinking every night, this group to know I was drinking every night. And I wanted to make sure that they all just kind of saw me drink occasionally, so no one would question my drinking. So I come home, take a break for a little while, just get drunk. During that period, I definitely called in a couple times sick, may have gone in drunk. Where I worked, it really make a difference. I worked for a hunting and fishing store in Ashland, and they were all drunk. We had a physical inventory on New Year's Day. I'm not sure really why. That was a smart idea from the owner, who happened to be my father. I don't know. You can't count when you're drunk. And half of the staff was throwing up at noon because they were all getting sober, because they were all drunk when they showed up. I don't know how you get an accurate count of people who've been drunk, but it's changed now. I just continued doing it. So I'll come back. This is my first semester of freshman year. Second semester of freshman year is where things got real, and they got real scary for me. First couple of weeks, I go back to school, and my thought process was, I just took 3 weeks off of school. I can take the first week of school. Really, they don't do anything. Just hand out the syllabus, and they just kind of do some real just basic stuff. I don't really need to go. So I didn't go to school the first week. Just got drunk, high, whatever. Second week rolls around. I really don't think I can. I don't need to go. They're just going to go over like the first couple chapters. I can read a book. I'm not a dummy. So I don't go to the second week. Third week rolls around. It's like, hey, Chaz, you going to class yet? No, I haven't really gone to class yet. What's going on in class? Well, we're having a test next week. Okay. Interesting. Okay. So, again, I'm starting with 5 classes. 2 of the ones that I had to drop last semester. So I'm going again. come the fourth week, it's like, you know, I needed to drop those two classes again because I'm not going to class. I'm not doing the work. It's a failing grade. And so getting an F, I'll take a W for a withdrawal. So, you know, I don't want the F. So I've got three classes going on. Sometime around spring break rolls around and things are kind of, they're getting scary. I know like impending doom is rolling around in my head. Like this house of cards is going to fall down. I know it is. And I don't know what to do. I'm going to fail out of school. I'm going to have, you know, my parents are probably going to ship me back to Richmond, Virginia. Like I love Dallas. I don't want to go back to Richmond. All this stuff, you know, I just kind of felt like the wall was closing in. Spring break came and went. I went back to school for about a week, week and a half. And during that period, one of the outside issues that I was doing a lot of, I had a scary point where I thought my heart was going to explode. I'd never felt that way before. And it kind of gave me a little wake-up call. Like, I probably need to stop doing this stuff over here. I'm about to fail out of school. About all of these things are about to happen. So me being the alcoholic, what is my way out? What's the only way out? It's like, well, okay, I can do this. I can do this. I can do whatever. Like, hey, let's say I need to go to rehab. Let's say I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. I need to get out of this thing. I can save some face. You know, I have a problem. Let's get me some help. So call parents, say, hey, you know, things are going on. You know, I think I have a drug and alcohol problem. I can't stop drinking. I'm failing out of school. And, you know, please help. So 4 or 5 days later, I'm at the house in Richmond. I'm waiting for a bed up in Hazleton, which is in Minnesota, in April, May, March, something like that. Cold is all hell, even in that time of year. Don't go up there. That's too cold. So I'll go up there to the kids' wing because they've got two. They've got like the adult section. They've got like the kids' section. So I went up to like, you know, 13 to like 20-ish something. I was 19 at the time. I like to call my experience up there. It was good. There was nothing wrong with it. I've got no problem with treatment centers. They did exactly what they're supposed to do. Give me a good taste of what they believe a good taste is of my condition of alcoholism. Introduced me to some meetings, the book, the steps, sponsorship, all the stuff that we learn here. Give me a good dose of it and then kick me out and say, you know, go do it on your own. I feel like that experience made me probably one of the most dangerous alcoholics because they talk about it in here, self-knowledge. I became knowledgeable about myself where I could talk you out of thinking that I was an alcoholic. It's like, oh no, I know what my triggers are. I don't, you know, I don't have to worry about all those kind of things. I just stay away from this kind of stuff over here. They told me, you know, I don't have to drink hard liquor. I can just drink the beer. And I was just a drug addict anyway. So I don't, as long as I stay away from that stuff, perfect. And also that helped foster and fuel my own delusion about what was going on in my life. No matter what I could tell myself, what was going on in my life, as long as I told myself things were fine, as long as I went to the gym, I didn't have a problem. As long as I, you know, didn't drink first thing in the morning, I was drinking in the morning, but first thing in the morning, I was fine. As long as I could get up and go to class, maybe get up and go to work when I wasn't in school, I was fine. All those things foster that delusion that nothing's wrong. You're okay. You can keep doing what you're doing. So I go to rehab, get out of rehab. My prescription for post-rehab, most kids went off to some sort of like a halfway house in like sunny Florida, you know, near the beach and all this kind of stuff. They told me I could go back to school. I was like, okay, great, cool. No halfway house. That's a positive thing, even though a little bit of the beach. Go back to school. I went back to school for the summertime, and within days, I was right back into doing everything I was doing before. And days after that, it was getting worse. You know, I had a girlfriend at the time. At some point, I got introduced to a couple of fraternities, and I chose the fraternities over her. And as that was exactly what I was doing my entire life. I always chose drinking over anything, relationship, work, responsibilities, commitments, whatever it was. Drinking came first. Everything else came second. Nothing wrong with the fraternity. Great bunch of guys. It was all me. And again, you know, inside that fraternity, I was drinking with these guys on a Monday, these guys on Tuesday, these guys on a Wednesday, to make sure that no one knew that I was drinking every night, because they weren't. They were going to school, getting degrees, and getting drunk like I thought I was getting drunk. They were getting drunk differently, but I was seeing what I wanted to see. They were doing all the right things, and they were graduating. So I was like, man, the fraternity life sounds great. So what? I went full force. You know, they're drinking and they're graduating. That's exactly what I want to do. I want to drink and graduate. That didn't happen for me. That coming fall is where kind of the wheels started to fall off. I'm doing a lot of non-A approved substances to manage my drinking, to manage my going to class, staying up, doing whatever. And this is a part of my sobriety, or part of my drinking history, that is wrought with my next way out. You know, I knew something was going to happen, and I didn't know what it was going to look like. And I am pain averse. I don't want to feel it. I don't want to go through the shame and humiliation of whatever it is. The only thing I could think of was I can't go back to rehab because I've already pulled that card. And the only other thing I could think of was committing suicide. And for the last six months of my drinking, I contemplated suicide every day. And I even thought about the different ways of committing suicide, and just to make sure that I wasn't going to be an attempted suicide. I didn't want to be an attempted suicide. Definitely didn't want to be there. If I try to hang myself, the rope's going to break, or, you know, my feet are going to hit the ground. If I go drive off a cliff somewhere, my airbag is going to go off, or something, my seatbelt's going to save me, or, you know, whatever. I am not going to burn to death because that just sounds like it hurts too much. I don't know about drowning myself. These are thoughts I'm having constantly. You know, like who does that? Like, sane people don't do that. The last thing I could think of was, you know, if I put a bullet in my brain, they are not going to put that back together. So that's what I thought about for the last 5-6 months. And that was what I was going to do. I was going to put a shotgun in my mouth, and I was not going to have the back of my head for the rest of my life. It was going to be gone. There, you are not putting that back together. And that started probably in September and lasted until February 7th. What happened for that last 3, 4, 5 months from September to February was drinking every day. I couldn't tell you the quantities. It doesn't really make a difference. It was every day. I was waking up in the morning drinking. I was drinking during the day, drinking at night. I was using all sorts of other substances to manage the drinking. If I didn't have a lot, I was taking some stuff to enhance that. If I had lots of it, you know, I had, you know, a giant party to go to over the weekend, I was taking a bunch of stuff over here. If I stay awake for 3 or 4 days, just bathing myself in alcohol and knowing that, you know, life is about to end. I kind of knew that it was going to end, because at this point, I was not able to really enjoy my drinking. I knew I couldn't control my drinking, but enjoying and controlling my drinking was not happening. Sometimes when I could control it, I wasn't enjoying it. And if I was enjoying it, it was way out of control. And, you know, other than that, there's nothing great that happened those last several months. I just kind of like, I existed. I went from party to party, house to house, friend to friend, and just got drunk the entire time. Every day waking up, today might be the day where I have to go kill myself because it's going to be the end. I think sometime in November or December, right before I left to come for the break, I had gotten to the point where I thought that it was real close to the end. So I actually went out and drove to a pawn shop that I knew where it was. I drove out to it, about 30 minutes away from school. I drove up and down the road that I thought it was on. I couldn't find it. I looked down, I was like, it's 4:30. Well, you know, maybe I'll go find it tomorrow. So I went off and got drunk. Didn't go back and look for it the next day because, you know, I'm a lazy alcoholic. I'll find it later when I need it. A couple weeks later, I'm out of school, I'm back home. I'm taking a break from all the drugs, just drinking because I figured that was the drugs were my problem. I'll just drink. And none of it really changed. I was still contemplating, you know, the end. So I knew when I went back to school, I knew instinctively that it wasn't going to change because I had not changed. Nothing had changed. I was just out of it. I was in a different environment. I couldn't get a hold of the things I was getting a hold of that were enhancing my alcohol there. And I still was just bathing myself in alcohol when I got home. When I went back to school, I lasted 2 weeks. The last 2 weeks, alcohol ceased to work. I drank because I like the effect produced by alcohol, just like it says in the book. It did something for me. Not only to me, it did something for me. It took the chatter away from my head. It made me feel a part of. I was part of a fraternity. I had like instant friends, and I felt like no one knew me. No one cared about me. I felt so alone and apart from in a group of 100 guys that were my fraternity brothers that I just, and alcohol took that away. I was able to feel a part of it with all the alcohol, but it stopped working. And it even stopped working physically. The last week or so, a couple of days, it's that last whole period is kind of fuzzy. My body started to reject alcohol. I was at a friend's apartment named Dan, lived in California. I can still see myself sitting on his couch right now, man. The six pack was over here. I drank three and I was throwing up violently. Like I had drank, you know, a half gallon or something. The following night, I'm sitting there. I polished off a 24 pack. I can't get drunk. It stopped working. And every day up until that point, I'm contemplating suicide. Alcohol is not working. I'm failing out of school again for the second time for the same reason. I'm waking up every day, going to the bathroom on my knees, throwing up. And I'm looking at myself in the mirror every day, seeing just this shell of whatever I am. I'm 6 foot tall, about 175-ish. I think I was 145, 140 when I came in here. I was skin and bone when I came in here. I was not eating anything. I was drinking everything. Some of those enhancers over here would also help you not eat so often too. So that's kind of how I was managing my life. So all of these feelings are coming up. Alcohol is not working. I'm failing out of school. I just this impending doom again. I'm not eating. I'm physically dependent on alcohol. I am shaking in the morning. I'm thinking I've got like a super warm comforter on. I don't know if I'm peeing the bed or if I'm just a sweaty guy. You know, I'm not a sweaty guy now. I think I was probably peeing the bed, you know. Good thing is when you quit drinking, you stop peeing the bed. One morning, I got up like I did every morning, crawled to the bathroom, threw up, put my contacts in, and I don't know what it was, but I saw myself in the mirror, and I saw myself for what I had become, and that was nothing. I was nothing. I'd ceased to have any dreams. I didn't see myself in a white picket fence house with kids and a dog and a job. There was nothing. Like, there was no future. There was, what am I going to, how am I going to get my drink today? There was no, what's going to happen tomorrow. All my dreams are gone. I'm contemplating suicide. Like, I see this shell of a thing in front of me. And I don't know if I remembered anything from my rehab past about prayer and God. I just said, I need help. God help. That's it. It was as simple as that. There was no condition, no do this and I'll do this. It was just, I need help. And I think at that point, that's when my first surrender happened. And I had my contacts in. I just kind of turned around, put a shirt on, called my parents and said, hey, I got honest with them and what was going on. I was supposed to be going to meetings, seeing a counselor. I was living in a sober dorm. I forgot that. Part of my recommendation from rehab was to go back to school and live in the sober dorm where you're not supposed to have any alcohol. I didn't have any alcohol in there, but I was drunk as a skunk when you walked in. If you were caught drinking or drunk or any of that stuff, you were kicked out. Somehow I didn't get kicked out. I didn't find it. My roommate knew exactly what was going on. He knew. But he didn't rat me out. I called him, got fessed up. Next 3 days, I did drink for the next couple days because I couldn't not drink. I was going to go through some violent nonsense if I didn't just at least do something to kind of like taper off. The day I came back, I believe was a Sunday. I still see myself sitting on the curb in front of the two different dorms I was in between, waiting for the taxi cab to bring me home. I can remember just like I'm standing here today. That was 26 years ago. I came back and my parents asked me, "Do you think you need to go to rehab?" I said, "No, I think I just need to go back to AA." Because something I heard in these rooms resonated with me enough where I knew that there was help in here and that that help could help me. I didn't know what it looked like, but I was honest enough with myself at that time to say, I think I need to go back to AA and see if I can give this thing a shot. Mind you, I'm 20 years old. I came in here and there's nothing but a room full of 45-year-olds. I'm 45. And you know, like and above, I was the youngest person in the room by at least 20 years. I did not think I had anything in common with you until you started opening your mouths and told me the way that you guys drank. And it was the exact same way I drank. The same reasons why I drank. You all gave up the same things that I gave up: relationships, commitments, responsibilities. They looked different because your lives were different, but the feelings were the same. And that, you know, that first several months of sobriety, I was going to a meeting every day. Thankfully, my father owned a business, so I went to just work for him because I was not capable of really doing a whole lot else other than just like some manual labor, clean the floors and, you know, stock the shelves and that kind of stuff. I found a sponsor my first week. He was 30 years old. He had 10 years of sobriety, and I was 20 years old, which means he got to over 20. So I had instant connection. He looked like he had his stuff together. And years later, I realized he had none of his stuff together, but that didn't make a difference. He had 10 years of sobriety, got sober when I was getting sober. So he showed me that it was possible because everyone my age drank. I thought my life was over. I was never like, all my friends are going to hate me, or I'm going to have this like, I'm going to go to all these party people drinking and I can't drink. And this like, life. I had such a negative attitude when I came in here. But the thought of continuing the drinking was so scary for me that that fear of not living a life that I thought was going to be fun, you know. That was the driving factor. I need to go to meetings. I don't really care what I think is going to be fun. I just, you know, no one wanted to be around me anyway. So what was I even thinking about? They all knew I was drunk. They all knew I was a terrible human, that I wasn't going to show up when I needed to show up for friends. So for several months, found a sponsor, found a home group. Someone thought it was a good idea to give a 20-year-old with a ponytail and, you know, 6 weeks of sobriety, the key to a church. I was the secondary coffee person. I wasn't the first person. I was the second person. They were smart enough to not make me the primary person. But so I showed up every week to make the coffee. There were still a lot of smoking meetings back then. So I was cleaning ashtrays at other meetings I was not a home group member at. I was just participating, picking up chairs, cleaning ashtrays, you know, picking up cigarette butts out front of the church when they were doing that kind of dumb stuff. I got involved quickly because I had nothing else going on. I didn't think, like getting sober young, I didn't have kids at the house. I didn't have a wife at the house. I didn't have a relationship, period. I was by myself. I had nothing else to do except go to work. I went to the gym. I went to a meeting. I went to dinner and I went to bed. That was it. Somewhere in there, I showered and brushed my teeth because that wasn't happening on the regular when I was drinking. I was kind of a shower when needed, and it wasn't usually needed. Well, still have all the time. Thank God. That's what my life looked like for months and years. Taking the steps, meeting with my sponsor on the regular, going to different types of meetings. Big book meetings, speaker meetings, open discussion meetings. We had, I'm not sure I started, I took it over, like a Language of the Heart book meeting. I went to all sorts of different meetings. because there's all sorts of different things you can get from those meetings. You know, the speaker meetings, I really do identify with, you know, someone's full story and how they drink, why they drink, the feelings behind it. Not, again, not necessarily what they did and what they lost and who they did this to, and what's why they drink. And the big book meetings, obviously, I'm not really a great alcoholic. I don't do a whole lot of stuff on my own. So going to big book meetings helped me get through the big book more than just with my sponsor. But so first handful of years, you know, I've been sober for a while. So I've gone through great periods of life, bad periods of life, and I've stayed sober through all of it. You know, at 28 years old, I, you know, had to bury my father from cancer. You know, I had recently gotten married, never knew, you know, I have one child. He never knew that that we were going to have a child. So I kind of, just kind of one of those things. He wasn't there to be present for my current wife and I's wedding. I've buried grandparents. I can't tell you how many funerals I've gone to for people in the program, from overdoses, suicides, natural causes, you know, sober, not sober, and you can name it. I mean, I was 2 years sober. And I went to Texas to go make some amends, kind of to put the old life to bed. Like, let's just, I need to make some amends. We're going to throw this thing not under the rug. We're going to put this in the past and use this for, you know, experiences to help other people, but I need to put this to bed. I got a phone call the last day I was there from one of our home group members, that Jared, who was a young guy coming down from Fredericksburg to almost Chester, solid hour every Saturday night, was one of the only young people's meetings in the area, and hung himself in his grandmother's closet, 9 months sober. Couldn't handle it. And, you know, I've had plenty of that. The first drunk log or drunk experience I told you all about, at Jimmy Clary's house. One of those guys was sober 2 years in the program, and he had a new wife, had one, or I can't remember if it was one or two kids. He drove off to a wooded area, walked off in the woods, and shot himself. Mm-hmm. 2 years sober. I mean, it's just, I don't know his program or what was going on in his life, but I know I've had, you know, periodic bouts with, you know, depression, but not that bad. I know what it's like to contemplate suicide every day for periods of your life. I can say that the work I've done in this program and the fourth and fifth step, identifying my character defects, you know, and especially 10, 11, and 12 with called the maintenance steps. I've been doing a lot of work on what kind of like is involved in the 10th step, and that principle of watching, you know, watching where I show up, watching where my character defects are flared in life and how I either react to that or not, depending on how spiritually fit I am, is kind of where I'm, the period of sobriety I'm at right now. But a significant part of my story kind of happened when I got around my divorce. So around 2013, my ex-wife and I were not doing so hot, and we were going through marriage counseling and all sorts of stuff, and just nothing was changing. So if nothing's changing, something needs to change. You know, I'll just say my side. I felt like I was doing some things that I was being asked to do, and those things were not being reciprocated, where, you know, the other side was not doing the things that they were being asked to do by the counselor. It had been going on for long enough and nothing was changing. So I decided to make a change. Asked for divorce. I moved out. We had a really ugly 2 year period of just not good. But in that time period, up until that time period, I had gotten away from going to meetings, a lot of meetings. I had gotten away from really talking to my sponsor or any kind of like real book work. I was going to my home group, was a Tuesday night, take it or leave it. And I was kind of self-sponsoring, and that's not a great place to be in. I was pretty irritable, restless, and discontent. Now, I had some things going on with the divorce and things like that, but I was kind of at a not a jumping off point, so I wasn't really contemplating drinking or not, but I was contemplating, leaving AA and just kind of going on my own. And that really would have been a death sentence because I know what that looks like. I watched other people do that. I decided to go to a couple other meetings immediately after I had left the house, and I found a new sponsor. And I guess I was at the right spot at the right time. I was 14 years sober to 13, 14 years sober. And I started going through the book again. And the guy I picked to be my sponsor really took me through the book in a different way that I had never been through the book before. And really outlined how a fourth step needed to be done, how, we did the fifth step together. He rearranged some of the words in the book to, make some questions instead of statements to really find out how do I show up in life? How am I doing? Where is my self-centeredness really showing up and flaring in life? And actually identifying what things do push that button. Because, at some point, I'm 14 years sober. I know there's a power greater than myself. It is, I call it God. It's just easy. I've had a spiritual experience up until this point. I've had spiritual awakenings and all of that stuff. So I know there's a God. I need to bring that God back into my life. I hadn't gotten out of the practice of inviting a higher power into my life on a daily basis to help me show up better than I want to show up in a given day. Today, that can be, just, when I wake up and I really don't want to go to the gym. I'm kind of pissed about that. That's me showing up and thinking that I have the best plan for today. That's where I was in 2013. I was without a higher power. I was without direction because I was directing myself. Fast forward about a year, into this new relationship with a sponsor. This is how God works in my life and other people's lives, kind of behind the scenes. My sponsorship family, there were about eight of us. After I came into the family, one person with a long-term relationship started going through a breakup. They weren't married, but they've been together like 10 or 15 years, going through a breakup, separating all their stuff. The next dude over, 5-year relationship, disappeared, dissolved, gone. My sponsor, divorce, that kind of stuff. I was the first one coming in, so he was helping me manage all those emotions for you just got, you're expecting you out of someone else. Stop doing that kind of talk about, when I would come and a bitch about the latest thing that she did to me or she's doing here. She wants this and that's outrageous and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, stop expecting you out of her. Stop expecting, rational behavior out of an irrational person. And if he couldn't figure something else out, because it's always, where did I start the ball rolling? And it's like, oh yeah, I did do that, didn't I? So, okay, well, some level, it's on me. If he couldn't figure it out, I always started the ball. He always ended up with, you did marry her, so you're kind of tied to her. You got to get over it. So it was just kind of, he helped me with all this stuff. And for the next 2 or 3 years, I was able to help all these other guys go through that same long-term relationship breakup and the pain and the what do I do now? And she's doing this nasty stuff to me. How do I deal with those emotions so I don't bring that into work or into any other relationship with my kids or anyone else? How do I identify what's going on with me? We're able to work through that stuff together. And it just, that's not me working that. That's my higher power. My higher power put me in that family for a reason. Helped me go through that big book process, which I'd never gone through before, which was a really eye-opening and life-changing experience, and gave me the opportunity to help some other guys because the pain and anguish and irritation that that lady has given me for the last 7 painful years, opportunities for growth, FGOs. I've had lots of them, but all of those irritations I've been able to turn into helpful suggestions for other guys going through the same stuff. There was gentleman this past Wednesday shared something. He's going through some similar situations and irritations with an ex. And I was able to share with him some experiences I've had with that to help him through his process. That's kind of been the biggest thing that I found in this program. When I came in here, I was such a taker. I'm getting from you what I need or what I think I need. And I was never giving anything. You know, today I get more enjoyment out of showing up for someone else and helping them do whatever it is they need to do or get through whatever they need to get through, process whatever feeling they're going to go through, than I do when I get something from them. And, you know, that helps me show up, I hope, better in my home life. Wife, yes, maybe. Okay, good. Make sure she's here to make sure I don't lie. I am definitely not a perfect person. I show up terribly sometimes. I will screw up, and my self-centeredness will get in the way of life. And I guess one of the things that's always been true for me has been a good test of where I am in my program is how am I doing at home? How am I treating my wife and my kids? And the days I'm treating them well, I feel like I'm doing okay. The days that I don't show up so hot, or I'm a little short, or I might pull a gasket, or, you know, I try not to do it. That's nothing really bad in the house anyway. It's like, you know, usually when I get irritated and blow up, it's usually because I've done something stupid myself. But that's where I test my programs inside the house. It's easy to deal with coworkers because I can remove myself from them. You know, if someone in a meeting irritates me, you know, I'm going home. They're staying here. It's, you know, it'll be over in minutes. I can't get out of the people in the house. So as long as if I have been doing my prayers like I'm supposed to, which I usually do them quietly, if I've been inviting my higher power into my life in the morning like I'm supposed to in the 11th step, if I've been thanking him in the evening during my evening review, and if I'm working a good 10th step where I'm watching where selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear pop up in my life on a daily basis, you know, I'm burning less energy being angry. I'm more of an example of good living, else we'll call it. You know, I was not living so hot when I came in here. I was not giving back to life. I was taking as much as I could get without giving anything back. And if I was giving something back, I was expecting something in return. I wanted to be shown that, you know, hey, I'm doing this for you. You know, bring it back. Life today is a whole lot different. I've got two daughters. I've got a daughter on loan from Italy. We have an exchange student that came with us in August, 17-year-old named Greta. She leaves next week, which will be really sad. Not next week and a half, 10 days, something like that. She's our third daughter. And it's going to be hard, kind of hard to let her go. But she's seen me, you know, bring guys to the garage for, you know, 6 o'clock Saturday morning, you know, or meetings and, you know, sponsee meetings. I go to meetings, you know, a couple times a week. During the week, she started to ask me, are you going to a meeting tonight? You going to a meeting tonight? I haven't brought her to a meeting yet. We may have to do that. One of those experiences we might have to have before she goes back. But, you know, I never would have had that kind of experience had I not gotten sober. And I wouldn't have had that experience had I not done a lot of work on how I show up in life. You know, how to remove the self-centeredness out of my life so I can actually think about you. Because all I was doing was thinking about me. You know, I wasn't just self-centered is what it is. You know, I didn't think too little of myself or too much of myself. All I thought about was me. And if all of my focus is me, there's no room for you. And the more I pray, the more room I have for you in my life. That's where I want to live today. Billy, thank you for having me. I think I'm going to pass.
Yeah.